Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Dr. Michael Oren joins me now from Israel. Dr. Oren, UCLA, you've lectured there, haven't you?
I'd like to, sure. Where haven't I lectured? Yes, I have.
And UCI, I know you memorably got heckled by the Islamists there. What do you make of what's going on in American campuses this morning?
I think it's an assault on America. It's assault on America disguised as an assault on Israel, which it is. But far beyond that, it's something much, much deeper. I was reading an article today in the Guardian by a Yale undergraduate. And it's very instructive, and I just want to read you one paragraph, okay? It says, it talks about this, the faculty support for the protesters, and this is at Yale, okay? And the undergraduate writes the following: I go to a school that offers classes called Contesting Injustice, Political Protests, and the Liberation Movement. Yale is a member of the greater systems, machines, and institutions which perpetuate oppression, yet teaches us to knock them down. That great?
You know, we're not old enough to have been there in 1968.
The word Israel's not even in there.
I can remember the books about Tom. Tom Hayden became a friend of mine, and he'd laugh about the weathermen, even though the weathermen were not a laughing matter. Dr. Oren, let's go to the important stuff. Hamas has rejected the latest offer. The war cabinet meets at 6:30 p.m. Israeli time. What do you expect them to decide?
They have to decide on going into Rafah. And by the way, of course, it was no surprise that Hamas rejected the offer. I mean, why would they accept the offer, Hugh? The world, particularly the United States, is telling them to hold on, that they're going to hold Israel back. All right. It's a strange policy. What can I say? I can't figure it out. On one hand, the Biden administration says that Israel's latest offer was extraordinarily generous. By the way, very, very hotly contested in this country, and extraordinarily generous. And on the other hand, they say to Israel, you can't go into Rafah under any condition. So what is the message to Hamas? Keep rejecting. Why would Hamas give up solid assets to hold off an invasion, which he knows is not going to happen? It makes absolutely no sense. I'm completely baffled.
The rational actor here, I hate to say this because they're obviously irrational mass murderers, but the rational actor in negotiation term is Hamas, because they say no. And America makes Israel offer a better deal. So if you're Yahya Sinwar and you're in the tunnel, you just say no, and you make a big deal about considering it and pretend there's a negotiation. Then you say no. At some point, you've got to stop negotiating against yourself, don't you?
At one point, Israel has to say to Sinwar, Sinwar's got to keep on trying to basically bargain us down. So we've gone down from 40 hostages to 33 hostages. And Sinwar can come back and say, well, maybe I'll do it for 25. And if we go down to 25, and then he'll say, well, maybe we'll do it for 18. And it'll go on and on, because he has no disincentive. There's no America saying, you know, we're trying to hold the Israelis back, but we can't do it. So listen, it's either accept this very generous offer or you're going to die. No one's giving Sinwar that choice. So why should he take it?
So the most underreported fact that I would like to know from you, and you've got your hand on the pulse there, I know that Israel wants to get innocents out of Rafah before they go in. I know they built the camp. Have the Rafah citizens begun to walk to the new camp where they will not be bombed and will not be caught in the crossfire?
I'm told by the IDF that the IDF feels it can conduct this operation with the very minimum of Palestinian civilian casualties. There will be accidents. Listen, we had two soldiers killed by our own tank fire this week. Upwards of 20% of Israeli casualties in this war have been by friendly fire. I've been in war before, and I've seen friendly fire. I've probably seen more Israeli soldiers killed by friendly fire than by enemy fire. It happens even in open-air combats, much more so in densely populated, densely built-up urban areas where the civilian population doesn't have far to flee, and where you're fighting basically two wars at the same time. You're fighting a two-tiered war, one on the surface and one below the surface, with all those tunnels. No modern army ever confronted anything like that. So the Israeli army, with that all going against it, believes it can conduct the final battle against Hamas without incurring too many civilian casualties. That's the hope, certainly. But to have the United States say that under no circumstances, under no conditions that Israel can go into Rafah, it's not just unfair to Israel. It's bad negotiating policy. It's just no wonder that Hamas said no.
I've never been an international negotiator, but I had to negotiate with the federal government a lot. And you don't negotiate against yourself. Rule number one. Ambassador Oren, I want to talk about the hostage families right now. We saw the hostage video of Hirsch Goldberg Pollan. I listened to Dan Senor's heartbreaking interview with his parents. I know two more videos were released of hostages. So it's psychological terror being practiced by Hamas. What do the hostage families have one voice? Do they have many voices? What is their position on this?
There is a majority voice, a minority voice, put it that way. There's a majority voice, which is very vocal in calling Israel to make virtually every possible concession to get the hostages back. And some would even say Israel should, you know, declare that it lost the war and remove to the border and let Hamas take over the Gaza Strip again, and we'll fight another day. That's what they'll say. The amazing thing is to get the hostages back, because that goes to the very DNA of this state. But there's a minority group that says that they're unwilling to negotiate, even for their beloved ones, at any price, because they know that once Hamas gets out of Rafah, it will recapture the Gaza Strip. It will kill vast numbers of Israelis, in addition to those who already died in this war, and certainly on October 7th. And Israel will release from prison prisoners who have blood on their hands and will go back killing Israelis, much as Yahya Sinwar did when he was let out of prison in 2011 in exchange for Israeli prisoner Gilad Shalit. So there's the minority camp. It's a vocal minority camp. But the majority camp is still calling for a deal at virtually any price.
Okay, so that's the hostage family public opinion. What about Israeli public opinion generally? Do they want the operation to begin in Rafah?
Yes, they do.
Now, yes, Dr. Oren, you're a military historian. I want to remind people of this. I've never seen or read of a war being led this way. I am aware of Napoleon's dictum, and I'm going to paraphrase, if you're going to take Vienna, take Vienna. When does Netanyahu read that dictum?
I think it's also from, I think, the good, bad, and the ugly. If you're gonna shoot, don't talk, right? that's the addendum. Right, to the Napoleonic dictum. If you're gonna shoot, don't talk. There's been entirely too much talk here. That's clear. There's a lot of criticism, not just on the gross failures of October 7th, but also on the way the war has been conducted. Why did we leave Rafah for last? Why didn't we do a pincer movement beginning from north and south? There are going to be many questions that are going to have to be answered in the day after in this country, and many people will have to, as they say, reach the right conclusions, the inevitable conclusions, and resign. Don't know. But right now, we've been waiting a very long time to go into Rafah. There have been reasons. Sometimes the army has been tired. We needed to give certain units a break. We needed to pile up on the ammunition and maybe give Sinwar a chance to release some of the more hostages. Just give him a chance by pressuring him. It's interesting that those videos that have been released are released because Hamas feels a little bit of pressure, not much. And so, yes, it's about time we stop talking and we start acting.
And what will be a signal to you? I mean, will an IDF spokesperson come out and say the Rafah operation has commenced, or will it just commence?
It will commence, and then later the spokesman will come out and say that it commenced. But we'll know about it well in advance of that, because you can almost hear the guns from where I'm sitting. You'll see it. You'll see troops streaming to that area.
I had your friend, Yossi Klein.
Now, having said all that, Bill, if Thomas... Oh, how was Yossi Klein Halevi? How was my
It was great. And by the way, he had wonderful things to say about you. He was fabulous. But he is a man mugged by reality. And I read Letters to a Palestinian Neighbor, and Yossi was very candid that he doesn't have any bandwidth yet left anymore for the peace movement. Does anyone?
Not many. And I can only speak to my own family, which is kind of center-left. They think anybody who's talking about a Palestinian state now is crazy. It's crazy. It doesn't mean that Israel can't talk about it. It doesn't cost us anything to talk about a pathway. They always talk about a pathway. But actually creating a Palestinian state that will be taken over by Hamas in a matter of days, and nobody in the United States can guarantee that's not going to happen. Nobody. Especially if it's a Democratic state, 85% of the Palestinians support Hamas.
What I did talk with Yossi about, and he mentioned you, is looking back, and we got a minute to the break. Did Sharon make the right decision to retreat from Gaza in 2005?
Well, he made part of the right decision. I'm more equivocal about it and say that, you know, we didn't have to withdraw from all the settlements. We could have kept certainly the ones around the international border, and we could have set the rules for responding to rocket fire. Sharon said that when the first rocket gets fired, we're going to go back in, and they fired 6,000 rockets, and we never did anything.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The biggest story of the day is that Hamas has rejected what Secretary of State Blinken last week called an extraordinarily generous offer from the Israeli War Cabinet. The Israeli War Cabinet meets tonight, Israel time, at 6:30 p.m. I talked to Ambassador Oren last hour. I'm now pleased to welcome back Haviv Rediger of the Times of Israel. You can hear Haviv on podcast called What Matters Now, which is Times of Israel podcast with Amanda Dan. Haviv, welcome back. We miss you.
Thank you, Hugh. It's good to be here.
Now, there are a lot of reliable people that I go to who are my age, like Dr. Oren and Yossi Klein Halevi. Then there's you. You're a new generation of public intellectual in Israel. Do you find this disconcerting to have gone from an Israeli reporter, journalist, analyst, to being someone that everyone in America wants to hear from who at least doesn't hate Israel?
Yeah, I spend most of my time actually teaching, including college-age kids, and lecturing, and doing journalism. And so this is new for me. Very happy to be useful. But also, I'm not sure you have more white hair than me, so I don't know what these young people today.
Well, Haviv, talk to me a little bit about what you expect out of the War Cabinet tonight.
There is a very fateful decision that the cabinet has to make. It has to do with whether or not they go into Rafah. It has to do with the kinds of pressure that they're facing from the Arab world, including the moderate Arab world, the Arab world that's frankly not to beat around the bush on Israel's side of this war and wishes Hamas would be destroyed. But nevertheless, the politics of the Arab world, the politics in the West, the war has dragged on for 7 months, and there is this pressure for this this agreement. I have to tell you, 3 weeks ago, it was becoming absolutely obvious to everybody that Israel was going into Rafah. There were tents set up for civilian refugees to flee to out of the war zone. Israeli divisions have been called up. Call-up orders went out to certain reserve units. And that's exactly when Hamas, a week and a half ago, began to be very flexible on the question of a hostage exchange and a ceasefire, some kind of limited ceasefire. Over the last 10 days, it looks like Hamas has kind of decided that Rafah is something that Israel faces too much pressure and might actually delay or not do properly. And so the hostage exchange and ceasefire are off the table. The only way to get a ceasefire out of Hamas, the only way to get hostages out of Hamas, is to be willing and able and also to actually do the massive military pressure that is the only language Hamas understands. So I think that what the cabinet is going to debate is how we up that military pressure to get them back to the table. And if not back to the table, then out of Gaza.
Haviv, have you seen streams of Gazans leaving Rafah to go to the new camps that have been established by the IDF?
There are reports of about 200,000 Gazan civilians that have already left Rafah. That's about a fifth of the number that have to be cleared out so they don't get hurt. There's a good chance that Rafah is going to be the most difficult battle of the entire war, because about 40% of Hamas's fighting forces are hiding in Rafah, and they have nowhere to go this time. They can't run to the south as they've done until now. Rafah is as far south as you get before you hit Egypt. And so it's going to be a bitter battle. We need to move at least a million people. 200,000, it looks like, have already left. Not to the Israeli tent areas set up for them, but to other parts of southern Gaza, to other maybe even central Gaza. The Israelis have technology and checkpoints in place to make sure Hamas fighters aren't among them. I don't know if it's perfect. I don't know how well it's going to work, but there is that effort. And there is going to be this significant, dramatic attempt to separate between the civilian population and Hamas. Of course, that's Hamas's fundamental strategy, is to make sure that the only way to get to them is to go through civilians. And Israel's supreme interest, Blinken is literally in the region right now, is to have as low a Palestinian civilian death toll as possible. So 200,000 have gone. Hopefully they can do better.
Haviv, I know there are protests all over the United States, but do Israelis know that the vote in Congress is actually the real test of American support for Israel. It was an overwhelming vote of billions and billions of dollars. And I don't believe the world has turned on Israel. I believe the same suspects like Joseph Borrell of the EU, who were never with Israel, are just louder now. What do you think?
Yeah, I'll tell you. What shocks me is how badly the Palestinian activist world can screw up a moment like this. Because think about their situation. They are actually suffering terribly, the Palestinians in Gaza. They do actually need the world's sympathy and help. And how could you not translate that into specific hard actions on the ground, that the kind that the Biden administration has frankly been demanding from Israel, the kind that I, in conversations with you over the last 2 months, have been wishing and talking openly about Israel needing to do, that help the Palestinians, but don't tell the Israelis, I'm sorry, you have to leave Hamas in power in Gaza, which is just going to make sure there's more war. The fact is that Hamas has created a unity among people around the world, governments, parliaments, in support of this war effort, because Hamas promises more war. And so, look, if you're a member of Congress, the Democrats and the Republicans are divided on Israel. And the fact is that a lot of Democrats want a Palestinian state. If there was a Palestinian faction, if Israel faced a Palestinian faction that said, let's reconcile, give us our place in the sun, have some significant withdrawal, there will be peace at the end of this and not another bloodbath like we saw in 2000 after the Oslo process, or after we pulled out of Gaza, it ended in October 7th. No, we're going to actually create a peace. If the Palestinians could bring forward those kinds of politics, they would divide Congress. And good on them. But their side is Hamas right now. And that is uniting everybody. It's uniting Israelis. Deep left Israelis who yearn for Palestinian self-determination are fighting in uniform in Gaza to destroy Hamas. And so, yeah, I first of all, thank you, America. Second of all, I wish the Palestinians could do better, because it'd be great to get to some kind of end to this conflict and real reconciliation.
Haviv, I know, because you have been a guest on the Commentary podcast before, that you're familiar with John Podhoretz and Abe Greenwald and Seth Mandel and Matt Continetti and Christine Rosen. Yesterday, Seth Mandel said something that really stuck with me. His kids cosplay Harry Potter. They get their wands out and they pretend that they're Harry Potter and Hermione and all that. What do you make of these kids on campuses in America? It does seem to me like they're cosplaying Gazans, and in doing so, they are in fact disrespecting the pain that Gaza is going through.
For the last 6 months, I've thought that they're not on my radar. They're not important to me. They are living through their own little adventure, and I wish them luck. And, you know, I'm glad young people care about the world. I don't know. I didn't have a serious response. I think over the last month, I have really begun to see, people have been sending me, and we've been actually talking about, the sheer volume of videos, of speeches, of social media posts. And we saw this on October 8th. This isn't new, but I wasn't paying so much attention. That are absolutely and passionately in support of Hamas and lionize and celebrate October 7th. And I have come to the conclusion that these kids, in their crusade, in their attempt to find this religious fervor and go off and redeem the world by finding the enemy and destroying the enemy, are actually causing terrible harm to the Palestinians. Because the only thing Israelis, I'll put it very simply, the Israeli psyche is where Palestinian self-determination will be won. Within Israeli politics, within Israeli debate, the Israelis have to be convinced, left-wing Israelis, right-wing Israelis, in as much as you can, have to be convinced that Palestinian self-determination does not mean what Hamas claims it means, which is the extermination of Israelis. And if they're not convinced of that, you're not going to move them. You can sanction us and cut our economy in half. You can bomb us like NATO bombed Belgrade once to, you know, over Kosovo. It's still not going to work if I think that handing Hamas territory is going to murder my children. So these kids have been broadcasting the stuff that gets out of these. I'm sure a lot of these kids are decent people, slightly ignorant foreigners. Why should they know a lot about a conflict far away? Who just kind of, you know, they want the social networking of this protest. They want all kinds of things that are, you know what, they're decent, they're fine, let them. But the activist heart of this movement and these protests have been screaming and shouting about Hamas and about October 7 and about the justice of the massacre of Israeli civilians. And that's the part of it that Israelis see. And so in the Israeli mind, not only is Hamas the preeminent political faction among the Palestinians, the heart of the Palestinian national movement, the reason that even an Israeli left-winger can't withdraw from territory, but even their Western left-wing supporters ultimately are pro-war and pro the death of Israeli civilians. I don't
that's
know.
Right. I'm going to take you down and bring you back up. It's a radio and television thing on the Salem News Channel. We're going to go to a break, but I'm going to continue to talk to Aviv, put it on the podcast, play it for you later. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I am back now with Yossi Klein Halevi from Jerusalem. He's going to stick with me through most of the hour. I'm sorry. I'm back now with Aviv Redinger. I'm getting my Israeli experts mixed up, Aviv. Let's go back to these demonstrators. I don't expect kids to know a lot either, but I expect them to know what the Ottoman Empire is, what the British Mandate was, and what happened in Jerusalem in AD 70 with the Romans. They don't know that. Do you think they actually understand Hamas? Do they really understand what Hamas wants?
I think there's a diversity of groups there. There are a lot of kids who just, they saw on TikTok dead children. I want that to make them horrified and sad and angry and mobilize them. That's the good thing that we saw it's a war, and it's a war in which one side is deeply embedded as its fundamental strategy underneath civilians. That's not new. It's not a new strategy. The Viet Cong did it. The FLN of Algeria did it against the French. But nevertheless, it is the Hamas strategy, and it's producing images that these kids are responding to. There's a lot of that. I don't want to take it away. But the activist heart, the people organizing, and the screams, the shouts, the chants, the explanations they give when the press actually asks them hard, specific policy and ideology questions are pro-Hamas. They're pro-Hamas. Hamas has the right, they say openly, to massacre Israeli civilians. And the problem for Israelis is Israelis believe, I don't know the objective historical truth, only God does, but Israelis believe that they have lived through now 30 years of attempting to make peace processes that not that they didn't succeed, but that every Israeli withdrawal, the Oslo withdrawal of the 90s that established the Palestinian Authority, pulled the Israeli army out of every Palestinian city, and they were having negotiations in 2000 for a full Palestinian state. That's Bill Clinton's version of the story, not the Israeli version of the story. Every attempt like that ends in rivers of blood. It ended in 140 suicide bombings that to this day Israelis can't explain. Palestinians can't explain to Israelis why 140 suicide bombings happened between 2000 and 2003. So Israelis live in a history that's their own, that they know instinctively, that American activists wouldn't know, because why would you know something? Just because you have an opinion about something doesn't mean you have to actually read about it or learn about it. So I really, truly believe that there is a huge number of just ignorant, decent, well-meaning students led by a coterie of radical ideologues utterly willing and even eager to see mass death among Israeli Jews, frankly, just who want to murder my children.
I think you're right, and we're going to come back live on the full stream in a second. Stand by, Aviv Redinger. When I come back, I'm going to ask Aviv, when they hung the sign Intifada out of Hamilton Hall at Columbia, did they know what it meant and what it actually means to Aviv Redinger, who lived through it? I broadcast through it. I've been on the air since July 10 of 2000, so I broadcast through that horrific sequence that was the second Intifada. We'll talk with Aviv Redinger exactly about what that means and what that banner signifies to the average Israeli when we return. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Aviv Redinger of the Times of Israel. Aviv, the banner went out in Hamilton Hall earlier this week, Intifada. And I thought, oh, my God, they have no idea. I broadcast through it. I was on the air. This show began on July 10th of 2000. So we broadcast the news every day because of great interest in America. But when you see that word, what does it mean to you? What do you think the average student should know about Intifada?
You know, in that one word, you can encapsulate the entire arc of the Israeli-Palestinian tragedy of the last 40 years. Intifada in Arabic means a throwing off, and it's a word that Palestinians use to describe attempting to remove Israeli military rule in the West Bank and Gaza. There were two intifadas. The first intifada was from 1987 to 1992. It was many things, terror attacks, but not just terror attacks, also kids throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers who patrolled their cities. It was experienced by huge parts of Israeli society as a moral argument by Palestinians to tell Israelis, hey, we need to figure this out. We need to end this. You owe us answers. This can't just continue forever and ever. And that sparked the peace process. That sparked the 1992 beginning of the Oslo peace process that saw Israeli soldiers pull out of all the Palestinian cities. And beginning in 2000, from about 98 to 2000, the Israeli army pulls out of all the Palestinian cities and they're having final status negotiations in Washington. And then in the fall of 2000 begins the second intifada. And that's the intifada that in the Israeli mind is burned into their psyche to this day. We live in the shadow of it to this day. And if you want to understand Israelis, you need to understand that intifada. Because at the height of the peace process, without any Israeli soldier in any Palestinian city, and Barak and Arafat, the Israeli and Palestinian leaders at Camp David with Bill Clinton negotiating shared sovereignty on the Temple Mount and permanent Palestinian statehood, that's when a wave of 140 suicide bombings begins over the next 3 years that shatters the Israeli left for a generation. These are buses blowing up in the mornings in every big city. In the city of Jerusalem, for example, most places don't have school buses. A 7:30 a.m. bus blowing up in the city of Jerusalem is a school bus, basically. I was a young soldier in 2000, and my little brother was in the shuk, the market in the center of Jerusalem, and saw a suicide bombing. He was standing in the road. He looked down the road and a bombing blew up in front of him that killed the daughter of the minister of science in the government at the time. The second intifada was a time when parents put their kids on their way to school on two different buses so that if one blows up, doesn't take both kids.
Wow.
It was a time when people were, it was a time that you can't, and it was 140. I want you, imagine, okay, on some deeply divisive American political question that really is a fracture in the culture war, immigration or race or something like that. Imagine a wave of 140 suicide bombings. What would that do to American politics? That's what it did to Israeli politics. And Israel's a much smaller country to absorb 140 bombings than America is. So we are talking about a shattering effect, and it devastated the peace process, and it devastated within Israeli Jewish debate people who said the Palestinians can deliver a peace. They can their politics can reciprocate our withdrawals with peace, because nobody knew what the second intifada was about. The first intifada starts in 87 when Israeli soldiers are patrolling Palestinian cities. There's kids walking home from school are passing Israeli soldiers running traffic. There's no Palestinian police. There's barely a Palestinian municipality. But in 2000, none of that was true anymore. What was the second intifada about? To this day, Palestinians don't explain it to Israelis, and Israelis are convinced that their politics are just too dysfunctional and too radical to ever reciprocate a withdrawal. And so the Israeli left has essentially been out of power since that intifada. So when you carry a banner that says intifada, and you think you're saying, we're Che Guevara, the revolutionaries, never mind how racist and violent Che Guevara was, don't ever tell them, they'll be very sad. But when you think that you're just carrying some kind of revolutionary banner, to Israelis you're saying, we're coming to murder your children. Get ready for the bus bombings.
Haviv,
that's a disaster, by the way, not for Israelis, but for Palestinians. That's the key
right
point.
Right. That is the fundamental misapprehension of facts leads to tragedy. Don't go anywhere, America. Haviv is going to come back during the break, and then one more segment afterwards. I've got to talk to him about the hostage families, and I've got to talk to him about the future of Israeli politics, because he's in such demand. People need to go to Times of Israel and get their podcast. Every day, Amanda does a 20-minute update. It's invaluable. I listen to it first thing after my own program. And then once a week, she sits down and does a What Matters Now with Haviv, usually, and others. And then Dan Senor fills in some blanks for us. But if you hear Haviv, stop and listen closely. I think you're going to be listening to him for the next many decades. Stand by, America. I'll be back during the break. And I'll be back on the other side for one more segment, two more segments, actually, with Haviv. Stand by. Welcome back, America. Haviv Rediguri is back with me. Haviv, I want to talk about the hostage families. This week, the absolutely necessary Dan Senor, who has really filled a gap in America, and his Call Me Back podcast and you being on it has really opened up a lot of eyes. He hosted Rachel and John Pullen, the parents of Hirsch Goldberg Pullen, Rachel Goldberg, John Pullen. And it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely the most heartbreaking, because I'm a parent of three like you. You're a father. You know what it's like. I can't imagine the pain. At the same time, Dr. Orange just told me there's a majority and minority view within the hostage families. How do you describe what the hostage families think about Rafa right now?
At the end of October, Defense Minister Gallant made an argument to Israelis that Israelis have basically clung to until now. It's starting to change, but the argument was Hamas aren't going to give us those hostages out of the kindness of their hearts. They took them. They intend to keep them. They are cruel. They are brutal. They are the mass murderers of Palestinians. It's never mind Israelis. They're not, there's no way to get the hostages out except by giving us hostages being the only way Hamas survives. Massive military pressure going to this war is what's going to get the hostages back. Hamas was saying at the time back in October, if you start the war, you won't get any hostages. Gallant said, watch me. And he was right. By November, Hamas was willing to give us massive numbers of hostages, including very nearly all the children. There's still two children left in Gaza. An 18-year-old woman also, technically not a child, but there are people still left in Gaza, obviously, many. But we got more out than anybody expected, and we got it out by massive military pressure. So the families have basically trusted the government on this question of massive military pressure. I think that the problem now is that it's 7 months in, and there is a powerful sense among Israelis that the leadership of this government, I hate to get political, but you know, as former President Trump said, it's concern over Netanyahu. Netanyahu is a deeply distrusted figure in Israeli politics, among the Israeli public, including among the right. In every poll, right-wing voters say they don't trust what he says. They still think he's better than the left or the center, but they don't trust when he says things. Netanyahu started talking recently in the last couple of months about absolute complete victory. That moment he started talking about a complete and total victory was the moment a lot of Israelis started doubting whether there was going to be a complete and total victory. And we've basically been stalled in a lot of this because of Netanyahu was bending either to American pressure or to Israeli domestic pressure. And that sense that you can't quite trust Netanyahu to pursue even the strategy that Gallant laid out back in October, and Gallant himself led it massively successfully, got out half the hostages. But we no longer have that trust as a public of Netanyahu. There was a poll just last week. Do you believe in Netanyahu? When Netanyahu says complete victory, 67% said no, 18% said yes. So the distrust is deep, and it's real, and it's deep, deep. And it's most of the Israeli right, not some. And that has created among the hostage families a desperate desire just to get them out. If there's not going to be massive military pressure that'll get them out, if even Gallant's strategy isn't going to work, then just give anything. Give away the bank. Let them survive this war. Let Hamas, they don't care about winning or losing the war. They want their kids back. There is a minority among the hostages. And by the way, I have such profound sympathy for that. They're the tragic story. There is a minority among the families that says, basically Gallant's strategy, we're still not going to get them out unless there's massive military pressure and it's Hamas's only way to survive. So please get back to the war. And they're just as angry at Netanyahu, by the way, for the war stalling as they perceive it. But that's the debate among the hostage families.
Well encapsulated. When I come back, we're going to look backwards at Sharon's decision to exit Gaza and then forward at the future of Israel. The next generation, the young men and women who have been fighting in Gaza or supporting the fight in Gaza, they're 18, 19, 20 years old. They're going to change Israel forever. And I want to see what Haviv thinks about that after I find out what he thinks about what Sharon did back in 2005. Stand by. Welcome back, America. My last segment with Haviv Rediger this week, and I hope you keep coming back, Haviv. We greatly appreciate it. Gaza belonged to Egypt prior to the 1967 war that was triggered by Nasser. Then Israel took it over. In 2005, Arik Sharon, then prime minister, said, we're out of here. And it was very controversial. I covered it and not sure it was right. Looking back, before we look forward, do you think Sharon did the right thing in 2005, knowing what we know now about Hamas?
It's a very good question. I supported it at the time. And I think my rationale for supporting it at the time was sound. And it basically came out, the basic idea, just so people, you know, whether or not I think retroactively it was smart is less important than what Ariel Sharon thought and what the consequences have been for Israeli politics since. So let me try and explain what Israelis see. The idea was that in 2000, the Second Intifada begins. By 2003, in April of 2002, after what we call the Passover Massacre, which is one of the worst of the suicide bombings of the Second Intifada, where a bomber walks into a hotel ballroom with 200 people celebrating the Passover Seder and blows himself up. I think he kills something like 30 people.
I remember it well.
And Sharon declares... Right. And Sharon declares Operation Defensive Shield, which is essentially an infantry invasion of Palestinian cities. It's rolling back Oslo. We left Palestinian cities. We took down not just the army, but also all the intelligence infrastructure. And we couldn't see the bombers coming. And so we rebuilt all of it. This was my war. I was in the Israeli infantry in a battalion in the northern West Bank during Defensive Shield. And it worked. In other words, in 2003, Sharon, in December, I think, gives a speech on national television where he says, my fellow Israelis, he's now probably among the most popular prime ministers ever who ever lived in Israel since Ben-Gurion. I mean, he is the man who stopped the bombings. Parents were putting their kids on buses again by the end of 2003. And he gets up on national television and he says, my fellow Israelis, I'm paraphrasing, of course, we're getting the hell out of Gaza. And his basic argument was, here is a right-wing Likud leader who smashed the Palestinian Second Intifada with the brute force, with an infantry invasion of cities. And he gets up and he says, also, we're leaving Gaza. His basic argument was, look, we discovered in the Second Intifada that when we withdraw, the vacuum we leave behind in power isn't filled by Jeffersonian Democrats. Huh. This is the Middle East. Vacuums are filled by bad guys, right? President Obama's withdrawal from Iraq was filled by ISIS, that vacuum. Now, that's not even an argument that America should stay in Iraq and bleed and spend for all eternity. It's just the argument that if you leave a vacuum in the Middle East, it's filled by bad guys. Not bad guys because they disagree with me, bad guys because they're going to destroy their own society. So we can't leave. We can't leave. They won't reciprocate our withdrawal with peace. They can't. Their politics are too dysfunctional. I don't even need to know why. At one point, Sharon even says, I don't know why. I don't care why. They can't. We're going to leave because it's good for us. I'm pulling out of Gaza. And if they come at our border after I pulled out to the international border, the UN is going to give me recognition. The Israeli Interior Minister sent a letter to the UN saying we relinquish any claim we may have had to Gaza. Then I get to shoot them because they're just attacking me over an international border. We're done, right? It's not going to be peace. It's going to be withdrawal and unilateral withdrawal and an end to our control over them. That was immensely popular. Sharon gave Israelis this gift of a double whammy. First of all, if they come after us, we're going to crush them. That was the promise, and he fulfilled it in Defensive Shield. And second, we're not going to rule over them forever and ever because it's not good for them and it's not good for us. So it had tremendous support. After he actually carried it out in August of 2005, it had more support the day after than the day before, and Sharon was even more popular. That's important to say. Sharon then has a stroke in, I believe, late November of 2005, and he by then had left Likud and founded another party called Kadima, and his number two in Kadima is now running for prime minister in the 2006 election. And that number two, his name is Ehud Olmert, and he gets up in front of Israelis and he says, by the way, guys, Sharon was going to pull out of the West Bank, or 90% of the West Bank. He called it the convergence plan. Olmert said, he talked about this before election day in 2006. He said, our good Arik Sharon, who we all love and remember, he was going to pull out of the West Bank. I am going to carry out a major withdrawal from the West Bank. People can Google convergence plan. They'll find his plan. And Olmert, I can't emphasize the drama of what I'm about to say. Olmert won the election after publicly talking about a withdrawal from the West Bank in 2006. Unilateral. We don't wait for their politics because their politics are too screwed up. But getting the heck separated from the Palestinians. Olmert's government is founded in March. He forms a government with the Labor Party. He gives the Labor Party the defense ministry. In other words, the left that wants to pull out of the West Bank is the people he's actually tasking with actually doing the pulling out from the West Bank. He then, I think 10 weeks into his government's existence in late June of 2006, Hamas in Gaza carries out, 10 months after we've left, carries out their very first tunnel operation. They dig a tunnel under the border. They pop up on the Israeli side. They kidnap Gilad Shalit. They kill two other Israeli soldiers. And there's now a shooting war in Gaza. In the middle of the shooting war in Gaza in early July of 2006, Hezbollah up on the northern border, the border with Lebanon. We pulled out of Lebanon in May of 2000. We'd been in Lebanon for 18 years. I'm sorry for the history lesson. It'll end in exactly
one minute. No, it matters. It matters. It's important.
Okay. We pull out of Lebanon in May of 2000 after 18 years there. You ever have that thank you where there's a lot of terrorism that comes out of a country and attacks you, so you invade, and it seems like a good idea at the time, but then you get stuck there for 18 years, and then when you pull out, the bad guys take over? So I don't know if that ever happened to you, but no. Don't do it. That's my advice. That was our Lebanon experience. It was essentially the Afghanistan experience of America. In May of 2000, Ehud Barak, the prime minister, pulls us out of Lebanon. 6 years later, July 12, 2006, while the shooting was happening in Gaza, we had just unilaterally withdrawn from Lebanon. We had just unilaterally withdrawn from Gaza. Hezbollah carries out its first cross-border attack from Lebanon. They kill 4 Israeli soldiers. They kidnap 2 more. And the Second Lebanon War is underway. Over the course of the Second Lebanon War, which lasted roughly a month, 300,000 Israelis had to flee their homes. Rocket barrages on Israeli cities of tens of thousands of rockets. We didn't have Iron Dome yet. The small working class towns of the north and the south on the borders of Lebanon and Gaza didn't have enough bomb shelters yet. Israel has spent billions building out those things since, but those didn't exist in 2006. And the Israeli public, which had just elected a government, even though that government talked about a withdrawal from the West Bank, and it was a government with the left, the Israeli public flipped on the question of a withdrawal. And they flipped for a very simple reason. The West Bank is 16 times the size of Gaza. The West Bank shrinks us down to 9 miles wide in the middle. The West Bank is the highlands that overlook all of our major cities. Standing in the West Bank with weapons you can put on your shoulder, you can carry on your shoulder, you can shut down our international airport and all our major population centers. The West Bank is dangerous if it isn't safe. It's not like Gaza or Lebanon, where if there's an enemy there, I can fight that war. I can have 5 years of peace between the wars. In the West Bank, I have to retake the West Bank if the West Bank goes the way Gaza went. So if the West Bank isn't safe, it simply won't work. I'm stopping the history lesson. The Israeli experience, this happened to the left, this happened to the right, is that every vacuum of we have left has been filled by forces that say they're in retreat, now you kill them. Every vacuum we have left has led to October 7th of one kind or another. And so how do I, in other words, a left-wing activist will say, how do I pull out of the West Bank? Not why should I? How do I? And we haven't had an answer since 2006. So Sharon's withdrawal from Gaza created the test in the Israeli political world, in the Israeli mind, for whether or not our neighbors, our enemies, the Palestinians, the Hezbollah, are capable of giving us any kind of peace or quiet if we do actually pull back. And the answer has been a resounding no across the Israeli political spectrum.
A deadly no. Now, Haviv, I'm going to take you an extra segment. I just want to warn you because I got to get a question to this. Hugh Hewitt's view, 9/11 changed America fundamentally, post-traumatic stress for the entire country because we had thought ourselves invulnerable to that level of an attack, and that all of the politics since then have been driven by a lot of anger and a lot of fear. What do you think this is going to do to the Israeli public? And I'm going to give you a 30-second warning before we go to break and then let you go on. But I want you, not political. I did that with Yossi. He explained to me where Likud will go in the new party and Naftali Bennett and all this different. I mean, just to the average Israeli psyche, what do you think 10-7 has done and this war?
In a sense, a lot, and in another sense, nothing at all. It woke us up. We'd been asleep for 20 years. We thought everything was manageable, or 15 years. I mean, that was Netanyahu's fundamental strategy, was this is manageable. We can, time is on our side. What is it, 17 years or so since Hamas took over Gaza back in 2007, the Israeli GDP per capita has doubled. In other words, as time goes by, we get more prosperous, we get stronger, we get smarter. And our enemies, because of the nature of our enemies, because they're tyrants, because they're dictators and they're terrible reactionary organizations, are destroying themselves and their polities and their societies. So as time goes by, we don't have to fight bloody, terrible wars with high costs. As time goes by, the power disparity only tilts in our favor. That was the argument. That was the dream. That was Israelis asleep. It wasn't a stupid argument. It just turned out to be wrong. October 7, we woke up, but we woke up to something, just 20 years of quiet being an illusion. We didn't wake, in other words, October 7 is very much in keeping with the Second Intifada. 140 bombings, right? Imagine 140 bombings in America over something that divides America, over race, over, you know, I'm sorry to do it, over the thing that hurts the most. But nevertheless, imagine a bombing like the Dolphinarium bombing in 2001 in Tel Aviv. A bomber walks into a non-alcoholic bar, that's a bar for teenagers, and blows himself up and kills 24 kids. Over race. Now, you know, I don't, or an immigrant does that, or, you know, it, the people who are on the warning side, the anti side will say, see, I told you. That's not the interesting response. The interesting response is, what does a progressive say? How does a progressive politics deal with mass terrorism from a side that in theory they agree with the basic cause? That's what happened to the Israeli left, is that the Palestinian political world produced this massive terrorism on October 7, in the Second Intifada, and every generation we've had it. So in a sense, very little happened. We just remembered is what we did. And it's sad and it's frustrating. We have to live on our sword. We have prospered very greatly. We are the safest, strongest, and happiest Jews who have ever lived in the history of Jews. And we have to live on our sword. And that's okay. It's okay to have both of those be true at once.
Stand by for 1 second, Aviv, because I got to go to a break, and I want to come back and ask you one more question, which is, if 100 years from now someone's writing the book about Israel, what are they going to say about these 20 years? Were you living? You said living a dream. Are they going to say, no, you refused to deal with the reality of what you were up against? Because in America, with OBL, he declared war on us in 1997. He blew up two of our embassies. We never paid attention. Then 9/11 happened, and there was a lot of recrimination. I'm just curious what young Israelis, the 19 and 20-year-olds in Gaza, think about middle-aged and old Israelis right now and whether they blame them. Stand by, America. I'll put this on later in the program and on today's podcast. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm back for a final 3 minutes with Haviv. Haviv, when Lawrence Wright wrote The Looming Tower, it sort of revealed to me and to everyone that I hadn't been reading Bernard Lewis. I did not know what was going on within the Salafist fringe of Sunni Islam. I understood Iran. But then I'm kind of mad that no one told me. Aren't young Israelis over the next 30 years going to distrust completely older Israelis who didn't see this coming?
I don't think so. And I don't think so because we live much closer to our enemies. We live much closer to our wars. And we all together pay the price. In other words, my father fought in the 73 war. His unit was overwhelmed on the southern Golan by the Syrian advance. He actually spent some significant part of the first 24 hours of that war behind Syrian lines. And most of his fellow soldiers in his battalion were killed in that first day. And I was in the northern West Bank laying ambushes for the suicide bombers who were trying to sneak over the mountains into Israeli cities to blow up children and operations in Palestinian cities. And it was a very difficult and painful war. I think I'm fifth generation combat soldier, and I'm from a family of nerds. We, in any other Western society, none of us would have been soldiers. And so I think that, look, we every generation has its war. And this generation has its war. And I think that's how they think of it. In other words, I don't think the current 20-year-olds are going to say, what were you, stupid? The Second Intifada, we thought, well, geez, we were wrong about Palestinian capacity to reciprocate our withdrawals. The 73 war was a mistake. The 67 war was handled phenomenally well, but nevertheless, we were driven into a war. 56 war was this massive Nasserite coalition of Arab armies that had gathered together, and we felt like we were existentially threatened. There's no generation. The enemy always surprises. It's the nature of the enemy. That's what enemies are. They're a thing that surprises you. That's forgivable. How you then react is the task of the generation. And, you know, this generation has shown that it is astonishingly capable and united and brave. And these are kids who grew up on TikTok and walked into fire when called upon. And so I think they will forgive us for my generation's mistakes, as I have forgiven my father's generation. And I think they have a great task to carry forward, which is to do better than us in the next generation.
Habib, we'll leave it there. I appreciate this great big slice of your time this morning. Very effective, very necessary for people to get the history lesson. In fact, I think the combination of ignorance and ideology meeting at the intersection of certainty is why campuses are awash with idiots doing stupid things, and your contribution to curing that is much valued. Thank you, Habib.
Thank you. That was beautifully said. Thank you.
Welcome back, America. One of the most thoughtful people in America is former United States Senator Jim Talent from Missouri. Here at the tail end of my conversation with Habib. Jim, we've only got about 4 minutes this morning. He gave a big history lesson on Israel over the last 30 years. What do you make of his optimism about Israel? And what do you make about our students on campuses who appear not to know anything about much?
Yeah, well, you asked for the students. It's a dangerous combination of arrogance and ignorance. You know, when you're ignorant and you're arrogant, it means you don't think you need to learn anything. And so they don't learn anything. And what you have to do, if you're the authorities, is swoop in as soon as they cross the line into disorder or illegality and stop them. If you don't, the problem grows. And then eventually the force you have to use is much greater and the situation becomes much more dangerous. So that's what's happening on campus. As far as the Israelis are concerned, they're going to protect their state. They have powerful tools to defend themselves. They understand what they have to do, and they're going to do it. And they could do it quicker and at less cost to everybody if we'd simply support them. And, you know, people like Tom Cotton and me and you and everybody has warned the Biden administration of this over and over again, but experience goes through them without stopping. And so they don't support Israel. Hamas thinks that the United States will stop Israel, and so they don't agree to the hostage deal. And why should they? They can always agree later if they want to. They know we'll force Israel to give in. So, you know, these are the realities of the Middle East. And until our administration recognizes that, we're going to continue bouncing around from one fiasco to another.
Now, Senator Talent, you're with the Bipartisan Policy Center. People can follow you on X at Jim Talent. But the Bipartisan Policy Center really is bipartisan. Has it broken apart over this, over supporting Israel?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. But at the same time, the stresses within the left are obviously very powerful. And that's part of what the Biden administration is responding to, of course. But it's bad politics in addition to bad policy. You'll notice it's not like President Biden's numbers have gotten better as he's equivocated on Israel, right? Because what happens when there's an issue that's hotly contested and people feel strongly about, if you try and go from one side to another, the people who disagree with you still disagree with you, but now they hold you in contempt. And that's what's happening here.
You know, his last question, Senator. Joe Biden's approval rating on Israel is -70% plus. I've never seen a number that bad. His positive is 28%. How does he turn that around? Is it possible to turn that around?
Yeah, you said earlier in the week, I forget who you were interviewing, that you thought the number was baked in. And I think you may be right. I mean, typically numbers like that don't get baked in until the late summer. But things are so bad domestically with inflation and crime and what's happening on the border. And this war is not going away. And again, ironically, if we had supported Israel from the beginning and strongly, if Joe Biden had been John Fetterman, it's possible the Israelis would have gotten this basically done by now. And if they had, that would certainly be better for Biden. The one thing they want is to get this off the front pages. But our equivocation has tended to drag this out.
And it's going to continue. Senator Jim Talent, follow him on X at Jim Talent. The Bipartisan Policy Center continues to do good work. I just don't really know what we're going to do with the left in America. It's gone over the edge, and it will not recognize the reality of history. As I said to Habib, the combination of ideology and ignorance backed up by absolute certitude, as my friend Mark Thiessen said, makes for a lethal combination. Thank you, Jim. Welcome back, America. Music of 1968 to commemorate what's going on America's campuses, particularly UCLA. I'm joined now by Joe Lonsdale. Joe is the co-founder of Palantir with our friend Peter Thiel. and the managing partner of 8BC. He is an innovator in defense contracting, and that's really what I want to talk to him about. But first, Joe, welcome. Good to have you.
Good morning.
I want to begin. First of all, people can follow Joe on X at JT Lonsdale, at JT Lonsdale. Joe, would you hire any of the kids in these pro-Hamas protests for any of your companies? I mean, you got like a dozen companies we got to talk about here. Would you let any of them in?
You know, if they apologized and grew up later and grew out of it, there's a chance some of them are smart and are naive, man. But these kids are, it's embarrassing. They're none of them can make any arguments. They're taught not to talk to anybody because they're not interested in defending their positions, right? They're just a bunch of radicals who just going along with this thing they're told to do, a bunch of woke problem. It's nonsense. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, at the intersection of ideology and indifference to facts and just deep ignorance of history, as well as certainty about position, is what we've got going on here. And I don't know what you're going to do. You are one of the co-founders of the University of Austin. Now, we're big Hillsdale people here, but I wish you well. Tell us about that with Barry Weiss. I believe Neil Ferguson is helping you with that. What's the program there? I've met the president of it.
That's right. That's right. But Barry Weiss and Neil Ferguson are my co-founders, along with our president, Pono Camellas. You know, we're trying to do a competitor to Stanford and Harvard. I think Hillsdale is a great institution as well. We're not explicitly conservative, but we are explicitly against this kind of illiberal nonsense you see going on. We're explicitly for the pursuit of truth. We have a really strong founding class starting this fall. It's our first undergraduate class coming in. And, you know, these things are set up. It's really hard. It's kind of a cartel. It's really hard to start a new institution. But fortunately, we have a lot of great people behind us. We've raised hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're attracting the very best professors. You know, Hugh, when we announced it, there were over 5,000 professors that applied because a lot of these professors are trying to flee these institutions.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. They're not coming from Hillsdale. They're not coming from Chapman, but they are coming from everywhere else. Joe Lonsdale, let's get to the meat of this. I got a friend named Captain Jerry Hendricks. He's with the Sagamore Institute. He's writing a book on how the Department of Defense accelerated its innovation curve in the 1950s because they were run by a car guy who was used to bringing out a new model. So as soon as they got one plane done, they started on a new plane. They were always constantly innovating. I don't think the Department of Defense can be salvaged from the inside. What do you think in terms of contracting?
You know, there's probably hundreds of thousands of people you don't need working at the Pentagon right now. I will say the generals and the admirals in charge, a lot of these are competent people. A lot of these are smart people. We still, you know, over the last 40 years, attracted some very good people who are doing good work. And they're seeing, you know, so Palantir took forever for us to break through. It took forever. You know, Palantir is a new prime over the last 20 years. It was very hard. We did not have Peter Thiel's, you know, financial and strategic support. We never would have got there. We basically need a billionaire to start these things. And, you know, Elon is the same with SpaceX. There's really three new primes in the last 20 years. It's Palantir, it's SpaceX, and now more recently it's Anduril. You probably saw they won that huge contract last week. Downside, it's only two companies left for making these really important, you know, AI fighter planes. And so now you have three primes that are broken through. And I think Anduril's great, and they're amazing people, but it was slightly easier for them than Palantir and SpaceX. And because the department's realizing we need to work with people beyond just the primes. And so it is moving in the right direction.
Now, Joe, I've got a son-in-law, and a nephew on active duty. The one is exiting right now, so I want to phrase this carefully. They are run by smart people. They're not defense contractors. They don't go out and buy these things. Who does? Who do you deal with when you're trying to? And I want to focus especially on Saronic, because that the Navy needs Saronic in a hurry. Who are you dealing with?
I love it. So Saronic, you're right. You're dealing with a multiple set of people, right? So Saronic is, we can't build enough big ships because China has way bigger shipbuilding capacity. But what we can do in America is we have better AI, better tech, and we can build thousands of much smaller ships that complement our big ships, that work with AI, that are weaponized. In a battle, you could have a big ship drop 20 smaller ships, and there's all sorts of things that you do to crush the enemy. And so we're making sure we stay ahead. And Saronic, listen, it does have to impress the admirals. It has to impress Congress, which is originally Congress has the oversight, creates the budgets, tells the Pentagon what to do. Then you have to work through the Pentagon. But listen, if Congress loves something and they put in, we're going to fund this type of area, and if the admirals do the tests and they have competitions, which they do, and we win the competitions, then you can usually get through the procurement. And is it perfect? Definitely not. Do we have to make procurement better and smarter and faster? 100%. A bunch of us are working on it. But if you build the thing that's the very, very best, I mean, the government, if you build something that's like 10 times better, so good that you shame everyone, then yeah, you usually can break through. Because guess what? There's still people in America that are still fighting for our country.
You know, I've got a couple of buddies. I mentioned Captain Hendricks. Captain Vandroff is now retired. He's running the shipyard up in Marinette, Wisconsin, where they're building the new frigate. Where is Saronic going to be? I hope you're saying Ashtabula. Where are you going to actually build the Saronic submersibles?
Saronic is based in the great state of Texas. I'm a proud Texan, as you know, the last 4 years. And right now we're in Austin, Texas, just a huge new manufacturing facility. And as we do more, we're probably going to get, you know, we haven't announced it yet, but probably going to do some really big manufacturing facilities on the coast of Texas is where we're doing it to start. But you know what? You know, a lot of my companies produce things all over the country. We have great things based in Indiana. We have obviously still things in Southern California. So you know, in Wisconsin is a great place to build too. So I mean, America advanced manufacturing is definitely coming back, as you're seeing. And you know, thanks to things like AI, we're actually able to produce here competitively with other countries right now.
Joe, I'm a Buckeye homer, so I need you to go up to Ashtabula and look around. They got a great port there, and you can take the Saronic submersibles down the St. Lawrence Seaway. How big are these submersibles? I'm really fascinated by this. I spend a lot of time talking about naval advantage. We've lost it. We have a lot invested. They might be sunk cost in aircraft carriers in 20 years. My son-in-law is on one right now, and he tells me I'm wrong. But what do you think? Is it going to be an all-submersible Navy?
Well, it doesn't just need to. It doesn't have to always go underwater. The new Anduril Ghost submarines are really cool, and you do want a lot of things underwater too. But a lot of that, you know, we're working closely with Naval Special Warfare guys, a lot of competent guys there. And there's different sizes. There's things that are 6 feet long we're making. There's things that are 17 feet long. There's things that are 30 feet long. And each different size could have different weapons on them, different sensors on them. You know, a lot of the ships in the Navy, the way they're built right now is they need extra sensors even to fire their very best guns accurately, which so obviously these are really helpful for that. You can have these go on missions. They can work as mines. You know, I'm going to tell you a story, though. It's amazing trying to work with the defense industrial complex. It's gotten to be very bureaucratic in a lot of areas, very slow. You want to have one of our new companies partner with a big prime, it takes forever. So you know, the Naval Special Warfare guys and other admirals said, listen, we want to see what it looks like to weaponize the larger size of the small boats you're building. Can you show us the specs, show us how it would work? Choose one of these three weapon systems. They mentioned three weapon systems from three different companies, and one of the companies they mentioned is Anduril, the new prime. And let me tell you, we got in touch with Anduril the same day, got the NDA done, got specs back and forth. Our guys pulled a couple all-nighters. 3 days later, we had all the white papers, all the costs, all the specs, all the designs done right back to the Navy in 3 days. And, of course, the other primes, they don't even get back to you in the first few months.
So no, I've never met Palmer Luckey, but he sure does strike me as innovative like you and Peter do.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to me, though, about do you expect Saronic to be a prime? Do you expect Epirus, which I also want to talk to you about, to be a prime?
You know, it's very, very hard to become a prime. Both those companies have a very good shot to make it. I think we do need a new prime in the Navy, and I think we could use a new prime in electronic warfare. There's a chance, you know, there's a chance that someone ends up paying several billion dollars or whatever it is and buys it out and brings it into one of the giant companies because that's a better way to produce at some point. But I hope it doesn't happen too soon because the longer you keep these things independent, the more you can have our very top engineering cultures attract the best people and build the best things for America. And a lot of those engineers don't like to work for the really big primes as much because those guys don't know how to run, you know, top engineering.
Well tell me about Epirus. Directed energy is what we need to defend our ships that are above the water. And we saw what Israel and the United States and our allies, and with some help from Jordan and Saudi Arabia, France and England, did when Iran attacked Israel. But the only way to actually do that over the long haul is with directed energy weapons. Where are you in that development?
It's going very well. No, you're right. So the problem is right now when you have these drones, or especially swarms of drones, if you're spending $1 million per missile taking out something that costs, you know, thousands or tens of thousands, that's not scalable on a battle over a long term. And any kind of long term fighting with our adversaries, we can't spend $1 billion every time they shoot over these really cheap things. And so what you need is a better solution, and you also need a better solution that's even faster than missiles taking it out, and that's directed energy. And so it turns out, you know, thanks to new AI chips coming from Silicon Valley, you get the power to hit an emitter, gallium nitride, all at once, and it blasts microwave radiation. So you can shoot high-powered microwave, and you hit these things, and you can take drones out of the sky very far away. I can't say how far because it's classified, but you know, it's getting to the point where it's miles, and you turn off these things, and it's, you're hitting them with a really split second blast of high power microwave radiation. So a lot of the old electronic warfare systems, if you harden a drone, you can put stuff around it, you just fly right over them. But with Epirus, with our system, you know, we beat the other competitors. We shoot things down over 9 times farther away than the very best guys who've spent billions of dollars on it, and we're frying these things even when they're hardened. So it's a really important technology.
Wow. Now, Joe, last question. Megan McArdle wrote the book, The Upside of Down. It's all about sunk costs. And for non-economists out there, sunk costs are the biggest impediment to innovators like Joe. Do the primes want you or do they hate you?
You know, sometimes they'll partner with us on certain things where they need to win. So sometimes they want us in the sense that they need us for something. But overall, they hate us. Overall, the primes don't like being made to look like the slow dinosaurs they are. They have these contests where they really try to keep you out. Like EPRIS, of course, we'd only spent $50 million of our own dollars. We didn't get anything from the government to try to build out these electronic warfare systems. And these other guys had to get billions of dollars of funding, and they had a big contest, and they said, these guys shouldn't be allowed in the contest. And we, fortunately, the generals these days are waking up, so they let us in. And, you know, and they flew the hard drones in the desert. And when we shot it down 9.5 times farther away, the generals were clapping, people were amazed, and those guys in the primes were kind of frowning. It was like a movie.
The whole sunk cost of the military. I also think, and I love the military, as I told you about, I'm a civilian, but there are a lot of people who built their careers on weapon systems which are going to be eclipsed like the battleships were by
100%, Hugh. 100%. This is why Palantir originally had to sue to break in, is that we were working in the Middle East with all the special forces, and the Army guys thought that we were preventing IED deaths. This is back in Iraq. So we let them use it for free because they wouldn't contract to buy it. They were too slow. And then the generals running the Army at the time, they'd spent billions and billions of dollars on a competitive system that didn't work at all. No one wanted to use. And they gave the contract to their friends to do it again, even though we were already doing it on the ground. And then when we sued, actually, the government, the judges agreed. They'd thrown out all the data about the lives we'd saved, and they hadn't even looked at us as an alternative. So a lot of corruption, a lot of laziness from things they're already doing with their friends, as opposed to working with the new stuff.
Godspeed. Connect with Sagamore. Connect with Jerry or Mark or any of these people. Come back, Joe. Post us up on this. And thank you for starting the University of Austin. Always good to have another innovation out there, and I appreciate the time this morning.
Thank you, Hugh. Good shot.
We're experiencing instability at every level. Our government lacks leadership, and Bidenomics has been a disaster. The economy is in a fragile state. Inflation has been a consistent issue. High interest rates have put significant pressure on the real estate market. There have been major bank failures, and many analysts say a stock market correction is likely overdue. We have global conflicts in Europe and the Middle East that have the potential to spread, but gold has soared to record highs even amidst the tensions. There are so many reasons that Americans should consider investments in gold and silver, and Legacy Precious Metals is the gold standard. I love Legacy Precious Metals because of their zero-hassle, education-first approach. They can help you roll your traditional IRA into a gold IRA or ship metals directly to your house. Go to legacypminvestments.com to download their free gold investing guide. I've read it, and there's so much valuable information there. Friends, now is not the time to roll the dice with your hard-earned money. Find out about the growth potential that gold offers you. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today and tell them I sent you.
We're playing all 1968 music today to salute the UCLA students who are being led away in arrest wagons right now. Joined by Josh Kroshauer, editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Quite a busy week in the world of college campus anti-Semitism. But yeah, here we are at the end of almost the end of the week. And yeah, what's happening at UCLA overnight looking a lot like Columbia earlier this week.
So, Josh, I asked Aviv Redinger this question earlier. What will the last 7 months do to young Israelis looking forward? What do you think the last 7 months will do to young Jewish Americans watching this unfold?
Well, look, October 7th to Jewish Americans, especially those left of center, was a huge wake-up call. It was a wake-up call that many folks who identify as Democrats, who are progressives or liberals, they're allies. They realized we're not real allies. They realized the depth of anti-Semitism in this country on the left. They see sort of the lack of courage, and you see, you know, the sort of the lack of outspokenness from Democratic lawmakers. Not all of them, but certainly like President Biden is giving I think going to be a notable speech next week at the Holocaust Museum about anti-Semitism. But his voice has never been more necessary to condemn these extremists. And they've been looking at folks like Chuck Schumer, rank and file Democrats, who have been eerily quiet or not as outspoken as they would expect in condemning what's going on college campuses. So it's been a wake up call. You know, I think among Jewish Democrats, even those more on the left, there's been sort of an eye-opening development that anti-Semitism is a real challenge and a problem, and you're not seeing the Democratic Party leadership step up to it. And Republicans, politically speaking, then this is, you can see this going on day to day, and I know you've been talking a lot about this, Hugh. Republicans see a real political opportunity, and I think you're going to be hearing a lot more from Mike Johnson and Republicans running for Senate in the House, focusing on this issue going forward.
Did you listen to Senator Cotton and the other senators at the presser yesterday, Josh?
I caught some of that. Senator Cotton has always been ahead of the curve, if you will, on these issues. So I'm not, and I've caught some of his comments on Capitol Hill. But look, we actually ran in Jewish Insider a very prominent state legislator who's Jewish and a Democrat in Georgia posted on social media that her colleagues are telling her that Republicans are much more in sync on the issue of anti-Semitism than Democrats in her state. And that's what we're hearing a lot privately, at least from Jewish Democrats, that see Republicans really stepping up on this issue. And they, I think some Democrats have as well, but they're waiting to hear from the president and waiting to hear from some leaders like Chuck Schumer of the Senate.
Most important question, Josh. I've got a friend, Stephanie, who helps me book my Israeli guests. She says that there are lots of Jews on the West Coast who are afraid to wear any public insignia of their Judaism. Is that, in fact, a national phenomenon?
There's been polling, I believe, the ADL and other Jewish and organizations fighting anti-Semitism actually have hard data. And I don't have the numbers, Hugh, in front of me. But yes, there has been a clear spike over the last couple of years in American Jews saying they feel less comfortable wearing a kippah or wearing a Star of David necklace. That has definitely been the case. And you see it firsthand, Hugh, all the anecdotes, all the threats on college campuses. It's directed most explicitly at people who are easily identifiable as Jewish. And so there's no doubt about it from the reporting we've done the last 7 months, but also just the data that's been coming in left and right.
Now, I have a friend at Chapman Law who likes to say anecdotal evidence is evidence of anecdotes. But after you get enough anecdotes, you see a pattern. And I do believe there are a lot of hardcore Jew haters in America. I never did before this. I always thought there was a small fringe on the right. It turns out there's a big mob on the left. Are you surprised by this, Josh?
Well, look, I would caution one thing, Hugh, which is that when you look at the polling, and one thing that makes this, I think, very a political malpractice, frankly, from the Biden administration is if you look at the polling, you still see, and I want to see some polls coming out on how voters react to the campus anti-Semitism and these takeovers of buildings and pro-Hamas rioting, because I don't think they're going to receive much support at all, even among most Democrats. And I think it's been a bit of political malpractice for the White House not to have a sister soldier moment, not to get out ahead of this. I mean, Biden is losing this election right now. Most polls show him trailing Donald Trump, trailing in the battleground states. He needs to shake up this race, needs to show that he is the guy who is appealing to the middle of the country, as he said when he first announced his candidacy in 2019. And for him not to kind of be very passive, he has put out, his deputy press secretary put out a good statement. But you haven't heard the president himself come out right away and condemn and not have these kind of even-handed type comments. Just condemn the anti-Semitism, condemn the rioting and disorder on campuses. And that would be a moment, I think, that could help him politically. In Pennsylvania, you look at John Fetterman. His numbers have shot up even among Democrats. He hasn't hurt himself at all among Democrats in speaking out in favor of Israel and condemning the rioters and the pro-Hamas faction. I don't know why you're not seeing it from more national Democratic figures.
Well and succinctly said, as always, Josh Kroshauer, editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Follow Josh on X @Josh Kroshauer. Thank you, Josh.